Is it 11 o'clock? It is. Okay, if you'll bow your heads, I'll ask, go ahead and ask God's inspiration. Heavenly Father, we come before you now. We thank you for the blessing and privilege of being able to study and understand your word. Our calling to your truth has provided that phenomenal benefit as you work with us through the power of your Spirit. We begin to understand your word, all the aspects of it, piece by piece, and it all makes such brilliant, logical sense as we look forward to all that you have planned for mankind. We do ask your blessing now and inspiration on this Bible study and on this Sabbath day. It's certainly your comfort for those who are snowed in, that they'll be all safe, and for those who are here, for your inspiration as well. We thank you in Jesus Christ's name. Amen. Okay, well, again, welcome to our North Canton, Ohio Bible study. We're going to pick up on this study where we left off some months ago. And I think there'll be a part three. This is part two of the origin of the American Indians. Now, the last part, we did a review of the current American Indian culture and an analysis of its historical culture in America. That is, in North America. We really haven't covered Central and South America, but they are all connected, as we'll begin to look at when we get into their biblical origins more today. But as we analyze the North American Indian culture, I explained a little bit of my own family's experiences. My parents served as foster parents in South Dakota, western South Dakota, for I think about 12 years. And they only requested specifically only to have Indian kids, which would have been members of the Oglala Sioux tribe, which their reservation, which is Pine Ridge, South Dakota, is about 80 miles by highway, about 10 miles if you want to go straight across the prairie from our farm. We knew quite a few of our classmates were from the reservation from time to time. The families would move out to the small ranching communities, and their fathers would work as ranch hands or help in the farming, especially during harvest time, and then the kids would be in school with us. We loved it. They were phenomenal athletes. Phenomenal athletes. One of my foster brothers played, and he was with my parents for 2 years. That was my last 2 years at home before I went to Ambassador College. But my brother was just a year or so older than Garrett, or Natawakapi, Blackhawk, and his last name was Wounded Head. Garrett was not tall, about 5'6½", maybe 5'7", at age 12, but I think, I'm only guessing here, but I think he had at least a 30-inch vertical jump. He just could jump into the air really high. And he was a dead shot with a basketball. It was with any ball, bowl sport, it was, he didn't have to know how to do it. He just could pick it up and do it. But in basketball, they had at that time, the farming communities within the two counties that we were a part of had a lot of big, strong, strapping farm and ranch boys that loved to play basketball. So they had a strong team, very competitive. And in that team of much taller boys, Garrett never scored less in 2 years than 50 points a game. And on top of that, he didn't like layups. He hated contact. So he avoided layups like a plague. I remember maybe seeing him do it twice in a game. He would shoot from the outside, and he just didn't miss. Had there been a three-point rule in those days with a three-point line out there, 50 points would have been 70 or 80 points a game. And the strategy was get the ball down the court and throw it to Garrett as soon as he's open. And then get the rebounds and do it again, and so on and so forth. He went through some difficult challenges as he wanted to go to high school, not from our house because he knew my parents were too strict. But he went back and stayed with his mother and got in trouble eventually. And he recovered from that, and after he got wise and moved, I believe, down to the Southwest, he married a girl from the Navajo Nation. And went through and got his art degree in sculpture. So he's a sculptor now in the Southwest. But again, another aspect is they're incredibly talented. I don't know of any of the tribes that aren't. I'm a klutz when it comes to artistic work, so I admire what they can do. And frankly, that in the past few decades, several decades, has been a road out of the poverty that it isn't. It's abject poverty because of the payments the government makes to all the Native American Indians in the United States, but the alcoholic poverty. They addict very quickly to alcoholism. At the Pine Ridge Reservation, the last statistic I heard, which is now a few years old, I hope it's not as bad as that now, but it was 80% of the adult population are alcoholics. 80%. So you think about that. What kind of a culture does that create? And part of it is that apparently, genetically, most of the American tribes are highly resistant to the effects of drugs. So it takes 2 to 3 times as much of the drug, in this case alcohol, for them to feel the effect. But by the time you're taking that much, you're in addiction territory automatically. And so it's a terrible thing for the American tribes in that particular regard. And I hope they can find a way out of it. The Sioux, this would be the Oglala Sioux. Most people don't know that the Sioux had a lot of tribes, 7 or 8 of them. They called themselves the Lakota or sometimes the Dakota. I'm not sure exactly why an L sound and why a D sound, but that was the general tribe for the Sioux Nation, but there were various tribes. Oglala tribe is the one that settled on the Pine Ridge Reservation, and their range was largely the southern Black Hills and over into Wyoming and the corner of Montana up in that section. You don't know the name maybe compared to Brule or the Yankton or the Rosebud, which is not pronounced as a flower, but I think that the Indian name for the Rosebud is different than that, or the other Vermilion tribes of the Sioux. But what you do know is Crazy Horse. That was his tribe, was the Oglala. Crazy Horse, there's a family in the southern Black Hills that are making a sculpture out of him on a horse out of a mountain, and they're doing a pretty remarkably good job and making remarkable progress, considering it's a family business and not a massive government project like the Mount Rushmore was, which is about, I don't know, 40 miles north of where Crazy Horse is. But that would be the tribe of the Sioux Nation that we had. Now, Sioux is a French name. That's how the French heard the name. Eos was apparently what it was, and this gives us actually a clue to the possible origin of the Sioux and then of many of the other tribes. So we're going to get into that. But I think it's important that we look at the various theories of where they came from. One of the predominant theories in our age is simply they evolved on site, and that they've always been in North America and South America, and that they evolved right there. Well, that's the evolutionary theory, and it doesn't make any sense at all, because nothing has been proven about evolution that's true. But that doesn't matter. It's a scientific explanation, and therefore, if it's scientific, it's true to them. And it's going to be a great day when those who think like that don't think like that anymore, and it'll be a great day for them, too, when eventually they come to understand that. Then the other evolutionary theory is that all life started somewhere in Africa, and they keep moving it around. It was in Kenya, and now it's in South Africa, the latest thing they found, which is a tooth, from which they can tell the whole history of mankind, just a broken tooth that they dug up someplace. And that then, you know, way back tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of years ago, the ancestors of the American Indians migrated across when all the continents were stuck together or something like that, because they would have been too stupid to build boats. Bear in mind, evolutionary theory means that anybody in the past was really stupid and anybody in modern is really smart. And the closer to modern you are, the smarter you are. The more ancient you are, I guess, the unsmarter you are, or the stupider you are. And that isn't true at all. And the more ancient history that is validated by archaeology and other research, shows that there were brilliant minds in all cultures. Some cultures just were hogs about it, and they had more brilliant people than other ones, but every culture had its brilliant people. So that's the hundreds of thousands of years ago migrations, and they finished evolving up here in North America. Once again, they can't have oceans, because how could people that don't know anything and are still dragging their knuckles when they climb out of the tree, how can they build boats and sail across oceans? You know, that takes some technical skill. So they had to have the land masses all connected for that. We're going to look at two historical origins that have been researched by men who believe God exists and believe that the Bible is the key to understanding where everybody comes from. One is a book that was written in Spanish by a man who isn't Spanish, Dr. Benjamin Ray. Dr. Ray was in the church and died in the faith. And as I understand it, because I got to the Brickenwood campus of Ambassador College a few years after he had died, he was actually buried on the campus. He was an American, but apparently when he came into the church, they needed a Spanish instructor for Ambassador College, so he went and learned Spanish. He didn't speak Spanish, as far as I know, before that, but he got really good at it. And so then he ended up as a dean of faculty and a faculty member teaching at Ambassador College long before it was Ambassador University, over in the Brickenwood, England campus. We were about an hour north of London in Hertfordshire. That was the county it was located in, not far from St. Albans. We were about 8 miles from St. Albans, and that is famous. St. Albans was one of the Celtic capitals of that region of England, but later it was a Roman capital. Romans had three capitals. They had Londinium, as they called London, and St. Albans, which I don't believe they called it St. Albans, because that was pre-Christian era when they got its name. And the other place was York, which they called Eboricum. Eboricum, the Eboric part, that's what the Vikings called it, was Eboric, because that was its name. That is a variation of the name Eber, from which Hebrew comes. So that's one of the labels of Hebrew that's scattered across across Europe, is in York. York is a modern derivative. It's just shortening Eboric to making the E kind of come out like a Y and drop the B. So St. Albans was one of the three Roman capitals, and we weren't very far from that. Dr. Ray did his research. He taught Spanish at Ambassador College. He wrote a book as his thesis, and it was called The Roots of the American Indian. He wrote it in Spanish. So if you want to read it, if you can't find his, he may have written it in English. I was looking on the internet here recently, and I found a copy that was in English. This is translated by somebody else. Another man who was a skilled Spanish professor, but was intrigued by the subject, and so he took it upon himself to translate Dr. Ray's book and publish it in English. I think Dr. Ray wrote it simultaneously in English and Spanish for the benefit of the students at Ambassador. Not that when I was there that we got to go over that. I found out about it later. And it became fairly widely available to those who were interested in the origins of things about 1978. This is when this version was published. So I'm going to look at that in a minute as we get into his analysis of where the bulk of the tribes came from. Now, the second researcher that I'm leaning on here is an Israeli historian who grew up in Australia. His name is Yair, Y-A-I-R. Davidi, that's David with a Y on the end. Yair Davidi. Yair is a not uncommon Hebrew name. And there was a Yair of the house of Judah who had several villages or towns, and maybe more than several, in the half-tribe of Manasseh's territory. Presumably he married into the tribe of Manasseh and thus had them. And that's in the scripture. So the front name is, his first name is from that. This is a book that he entitled Ephraim. What Mr. Davidi does is he researches where the 10 tribes of Israel went. That's his specialty. He has a big website where his books are available, and other research that he and others pool, and they discuss things back and forth. So if you're interested in wading through that, it's called britam.org. Britam. Brit sounds like Britain, the front end of Britain, and it is, exactly, but it's a Hebrew word. It means covenant. And am is a way to say people in Hebrew. So it's covenant people is what .org is, what his the britam.org, B-R-I-T-A-M. So in case you're interested, you can have some historical fun perusing that, or maybe finding Dr. Ray's book on the internet. And I'm sure that there are others who have written similar things. We're going to look mostly at the research these two have done, because I know that they strive to derive things from what the scripture says to start with. So we'll go, first of all, to Genesis chapter 10 this morning. Genesis chapter 10. As I was driving, we were driving here, my wife asked me a very important question. Why is the identity and the history of the American Indian tribes important? And how is that relevant to people? Now, the few of you who are here today, that's not a question. You're fascinated by it. You want to learn about things like that. And the more you know about the family of mankind that God created, the more fascinating it is, because we learn things from the study of history. Other people don't automatically see that. So there are reasons why it's valuable to do a Bible study on the origins of the American Indians, or even a Bible study series. When we're done, it'll be about 3 hours of lecture time in three different pieces. But to understand where the Israelites came from is important, because there are great promises made to Abraham. And those promises have partly been fulfilled, and there is yet fulfillments to come, which factor greatly into end-time prophecy, and even more greatly, by far, into millennial prophecy in the kingdom of God on the earth. So to study the life of Abraham has great value in anticipating and realizing the truth that what God promised him is going to happen. Now, there's another reason to study the life of Abraham. He's called the father of the faithful. So we study him to build our faith. Wait for the sermon today. It's about faith. And it focuses, you know, a great deal on Abraham, but not just Abraham. Abraham's descendants and associates, those who others, and ancestors even, that followed God. Now, we all came from Adam and Eve, so to know what we can know of the history between us and Adam and Eve is important and valuable. It gives us a depth of existence. Instead of living here and now with my phone in my face, because that's how we are defined today. You know, it's only been a few years, but hardly anybody can remember when everybody didn't have a phone in their face. Most of the times, phones were up to their ears occasionally. But now they're in your face as you're reading your texts and all the other things, or you're talking, you know, on the speaker, which is better for you than having it stuck against your ear and get the radiation going into your brain directly. Sort of indirectly goes in through the front. I don't know if that makes any difference. Maybe you have your front of your skull has more radiation deflection shapes to it. But it gives us depths as people. It enriches us spiritually as well as mentally to understand history and where things and where people came from and what others did. We learn from them. For starters, you can at least learn from their lousy mistakes and try not to make them yourself. Of course, we know that if time was to go on and somebody wrote histories of us and our families, that they would be learning from our lousy mistakes, which in fact we made. But maybe we didn't make the same ones others made in the past because we read our history wisely. Winston Churchill once said, the further back you look, the further forward you can see. So how far back in history can we look? John 1, verse 1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. There was Christ and the Father. Out into eternity, into the past. We can look back into eternity because we understand that. Therefore, using Churchill's principle, which I think, in fact, is a very valid truth, we can look into eternity, into the future, and understanding the prophecies of the kingdom of God from the millennium to the white throne judgment and the destruction or the nullifying of Satan's presence, his being bound forever, all of that, and then looking onto the kingdom of God, pleasures forevermore, as it says in the Psalms. You know, understanding the history helps us anticipate the future. So there are all kinds of vital reasons why we need to study the history, including, in this case, the history of the American Indians in the South and North America. We have a lot of brethren in South America and in Central America who have Indian backgrounds. Some have Spanish backgrounds or Portuguese backgrounds, but we have a lot of them, especially our congregation in the north end of Brazil, are primarily Indians of the tribes that lived down there from way back. Actually, they lived in Guyana, which was a country next door, and then they had to escape. They got to come back to Brazil, where their parents actually were from. Because Brazil was on an extermination policy a few decades ago of killing off her Indians, which is a terrible policy. So they escaped to Guyana, found out about the church, so they come back now because Brazil realized her mistake, which is really remarkable that a nation would, and is good. And so now they get to live just inside Brazil. We have fewer North American Indians in the church, but we have some. And, you know, they're brethren, so we get to know something about their background, an ancient background. And at the same time, we learn more about ours. So this is the genealogy of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and the sons who were born to them after the flood. That's verse 1. So the flood is over. There isn't anybody left except 8 people. Noah and Mrs. Noah, Shem and Mrs. Shem, Japheth and Mrs. Japheth, and Ham and Mrs. Ham. Those are the 8 people, and Peter, the Apostle Peter, stated that in, I think it's in 1 Peter, clearly that 8 people came through the flood. So we know it was them. Then they begin to repopulate. So Japheth technically appears to be the oldest because he's listed first in verse 2. The sons of Japheth were Gomer, Magog, Madai, Javan, or Yavan, the Hebrew would pronounce a J as a Y, Tubal, Meshech, and Tiras. Now, the sons of Gomer were Ashkenaz, Riphath, Togarmah. The sons of Javan were Elisha, Tarshish. Okay, we know the ships of Tarshish, yes. And Kittim. Kittim became the name for Cyprus. We call it, it's an island off the coast between Turkey and Greece, and they argue about, with arms in the past, who owns Cyprus. The ancient name for Cyprus is Kittim, and it means the western. It was considered west because it was west of Israel. That it was another term they used for the west. Anything west is Kittim, kind of picking up the name of the island that was west. So anything beyond that is just, it's just west. Kittim was the term used for that. And Dodanan. From these, the coastland peoples of the Gentiles were separated into their lands, everyone according to his language, according to their families, into their nations. Now, it says according to the language, we know then that this is a commentary that is after Nimrod rebelled against God and became the first world-ruling dictator after the flood. And he began to build the Tower of Babel. And then God said, okay, we're going to fix that. He scrambled all the languages. All the language families came into existence one morning. And these people came to work and they could talk to those who they knew and maybe were related to, but they couldn't talk to anybody else. Because they all threw their hands in the air and started moving away because they couldn't reason with people they couldn't understand. You know, the frustration levels rose high and the Tower of Babel didn't get built. And eventually, Shem brought an end to Nimrod, according to the ancient histories. But that began to push people out, away from Shinar, which is normally believed to be between the Tigris and Euphrates River. That was the territory that Nimrod had established. They began to move out in the directions that God wanted them to migrate. Now, he was orchestrating the migrations. Obviously, he orchestrated the language, the divisions, and now he was orchestrating the migration. Some say, well, Tower of Babel, but Babel means confusion, and God's not the author of confusion. It says that in 1 Corinthians chapter 14, verse 33, I think it is. And how could God cause confusion? And the answer is, lest you be dissuaded by that, he didn't cause confusion. God caused organization. To the people, it sounded like confusion to begin with. But when you're working with moving populations around the globe to the places that he wanted them to be, and he had already planned that ahead of time, this was organization. And God is the author of organization, good organization. And then we have the sons of Ham mentioned in verse 6. And the sons of Ham are Cush, Mizraim. Mizraim became a name for Egypt. Actually, Cush is sometimes a label for Egypt as well, but it's more for that northern corner of Africa and the bulk of Africa in general. And Put and Canaan or Canaan, and the sons of Cush were Seba, and so on and so on and so on. Now, we'll come back. It goes into talking about Nimrod. We'll come back to looking at Japheth and his sons. Now, notice his one, two, three, fourth son is Javan. Javan is the ancestor of the Greeks. Not all the Greeks, mind you, because many of the Greeks are actually descended from the tribe of Dan and other elements of Israel. And they were the ones that didn't get along with the Athenians very well. So you had the Athenian Greeks, and then you had the other Greeks, the Spartans and such as that. So not all the Greeks are of the same lineage, but Javan is recognized by the core Greeks that would be typified by the city of Athens as their ancestor. They believe that. And you think, well, hold it. I thought Japheth was going to be out in Asia, and that Europe would be Shem, more largely, and Africa was mostly Ham. And the answer is yes, that's right. But there would be peoples that lived at the edges, because the Greeks don't look Oriental, and they don't look African. They look more like the Shemites. Well, then that's why they're next to the Shemites. You know, it's logical. They got a border someplace, so you have your border peoples that look a little like both directions, and that seems to be the case here. Now, as they went along and settled there, we begin to ask, well, where did they all end up with? We can identify Gomer, Magog, and Magog for sure. Gog and Magog would be up into Russia. Gomer would be up that way as well. The Madai, the descendants of Madai here, or Madai, according to the histories, that's the Medes. You know, the laws of the Medes and the Persians. Well, at a certain time, the Medes were allied with the Persians. Doesn't necessarily mean they were closely related to them, but they were certainly politically related to them for a period. And that would have been down at the south end of the Caspian Sea and a little up to the western side of it. That was where the Medes and the Persians were. Ultimately, their power base spread, and the Persian end came. They came more from the south. What we call Iran today was the core of ancient Persia. But the Medes were down at that end of the Caspian Sea. Caspian Sea is here, and then going northwest, you have the Black Sea. And then straight west of the Caspian, the bottom end of it is the Mediterranean Sea. Now, the Medes, over the course of time, and according to the research that Dr. Ray brought out from various encyclopedias and historians, the Medes migrated north. Eventually, they settled in what was, before they got there, it was called Scythia, named after Isaac, S-C-Y-T-H-I-A, or Scythia. And you think, well, how could that be after Isaac? Well, in Hebrew, Isaac, or... Well, we're the only ones who say Isaac. Everybody else in the world except the English speakers, say Itzhak. The I comes out like a short E or a long E, Itzhak sometimes, or I, short I, Itzhak. So the core of the word is the S and then the hard C or a K. Ancient Hebrew did not have vowels in it. It only had consonants. The vowel sounds were handed on by oral tradition from one generation to another. So if they stopped pronouncing a word for some superstitious reason, then after a few generations, nobody knew how it was pronounced because they don't know what the vowel sounds were. So Isaac, you've got to think of the SK sound is Isaac. And you think, yeah, but SC is it's sort of a hissing S, like scat. Right, but cat isn't. Cat's got a hard C, doesn't it? So does Scotland. So does Scandinavia. So does Nova Scotia. So you see, the C can be hard or soft, depending on how we say it. Scythia, we usually pronounce it as Scythia, but it could be Scythia just as easily. Anyway, that was where the Medes ended up, as the ten tribes, where the bulk of them were part of the Scythian hordes or nation. And they, when they migrated in different directions at a certain time after their captivity in the 700s BC, then the Medi, or the Medes, ultimately moved up and settled in, became what we now recognize as Ukrainians, or at least a good portion of the Ukrainian people, because that was basically the area of the Ukraine. So we have them moving up that direction, and we have Javan moving to Greece. So Greece, and then you would be going north across the Black Sea to get up to where the Medi landed. So the inclination is that Kyrus, the last son, went somewhere similar. And when you go and look at the names of the islands in the Aegean Sea between Turkey and Greece, because that was all, the coastlands were all Greek in one form or another, either Doric Greeks, which would have been more Israelitish Greeks, or the Javanite Greeks, which would have been the core Greeks around Athens and so on. There is a town not far from Athens called Tyrnus, very close to Tyrus. There's another island, and these islands were sort of like small city-states at a certain time, called Teros, very close to Tyrus. Remember, the vowel sounds are easily migrated in ancient languages, especially those that when they're just moving away from the Hebrew. So we find that Tyrus went up through there. And then certain of the research that he found is that there were different elements of the Tyrans, as they would have been called, that are indicative of the tribes that the Indian tribes. Well, for one thing, they painted their bodies, tattoos or paints. Secondly, they had very high regard for women within their community. In fact, they were matriarchal to a large extent, so that the family name didn't go through the father, it went through the mother. Okay, well, that was also true of the Picts. The Picts were people that showed up much later in Scotland and northern England. And sometimes the Celts think that they're Picts, but largely the Picts and the Celts were different peoples. And when the Romans came to British Isles in the time of Julius Caesar, which would have been the first century BC, there were Celts there, because that's who he fought with, but he couldn't conquer. And so he decided, well, we'll leave this to somebody else. It was Emperor Claudius much later. But the northern ones, the northern inhabitants, painted their bodies, and they talked about that. That's why they called them Picts, probably from the same way we get pixels or different words that are related to paint. It would mean painted people. That's how he called them that. And they wore feathered headdresses, and we find that in archaeological carvings and inscriptions and things like that. And they were matriarchal in their behavior. And then when you realize, okay, they were there, but they stayed there, right? You know, that's what the different lines of reasoning for some historians, that people went someplace, they never moved again. And so they're still there. Not necessarily. Because when Claudius came with the Roman armies to fight the British, took him 9 years to subdue them, and a lot of subterfuge. They were tough. That was the British Celts. The Picts were gone. They weren't there anymore. So where did they go? Well, they went to North America, probably via Greenland or Iceland, and in Greenland, and you can leapfrog it across. We don't really know how they got there, but they got there. The Iroquois, who were a nation of the five nations, as they were called, five tribes that made the Iroquois nation in the northeast of America, had the same characteristics as the Picts and the Tirans back down in the islands around Greece. They were matriarchal. They liked feather headdresses. They painted their bodies. Great warriors and archers in particular. So we're finding the tracks that would lead us right into North America. Now, into North America somewhere around the first century AD. That's very ancient history. You know, granted, you can be more ancient. The flood took place about 4,500 years ago. You could have more ancient history, but the history that we have here, it gives them where they were in one place, and we find people just like them in another place, and then we find people just like them in another place. And actually, Dr. Ray looked at the names of the islands. Let me see. Some of the names were Eos was one of the ones. Find this little list here in this book. Eos, Tenos, Andros, Patmos, that one you know, because the Apostle John, much later, was imprisoned on the island of Patmos for 10 years by the Emperor Diocletian, I believe. Leros, Pyrrhus, Naxos, Akis, Sikinos, Anafe, and Carpathos. Those were all islands that are scattered throughout that lower part. And then there was the town of Tyrannus that I had mentioned before, and Tinos, which are all very close to the name of Tyrus. So his conclusion is that the bulk of the American Indians migrated, descended from Tyrus, the son of Japheth, and moved up north into the islands of Greece. Then from there, I left out an intermediate step, they moved into Thrace and Illyria. You're like, well, where's that? Well, Thrace is just north of Macedonia, which is right on the northern border of Greece. So you have Greece, Macedonia, and then Thrace started somewhere where Macedonia today, modern Macedonia, is, began to be Thrace. And then Illyria was the nation, or the land area north of that. And so they were found there. Again, the same cultural markers were written about by Herodotus in 450 B.C., and so on, and ultimately then they were found on clear across Europe in the British Isles, and then the next place they're located is when the American colonists and the French and the English came and found them people who were just a lot like that. You know, the same cultures, the same tenets of their culture, and thus becoming the father of many of the tribes. Dr. Ray thinks that perhaps the Sioux themselves were descended from Japheth. And that's distinctly possible. Now, let's talk about another possibility in the next few minutes. We'll try to be done on the hour. And this is the one that Yair Davidi brings. Let's go to Genesis 25 for this one. Now, he concentrates on tracking where the 12 tribes went. He also, in doing that, you end up tracking where other tribes went, other elements of the nations moved to, because the Israelites were bumping up against them. So you think, well, who were they fighting with here? Or who were they getting along with there? That's all important. So look at the genealogy of Ishmael in Genesis 25. Now, Ishmael, we know who Ishmael was. The father was Abraham. His mother was Hagar. And but Ishmael was not the son of promise. God told Abraham that he would have a son and that his son would receive the promises. But he said that Ishmael was not the son of promise. Now, not that Ishmael did not have descendants. He had 12 tribes. But the son of promise would be Isaac. Isaac would only have two sons, but one of them would be Jacob. And Jacob would have his name changed to Israel, and his 12 sons became the 12 tribes of Israel. So we're looking at Ishmael now. This is the genealogy of Ishmael, Abraham's son, whom Hagar the Egyptian, Sarah's maidservant, bore to Abraham. That's in verse 12. Verse 13. And these were the names of the sons of Ishmael, by their names according to their generations. The firstborn of Ishmael was Nebayoth, or Nevayoth. It is sometimes spelled with a V instead of a B. Victor versus boy. And you think, well, yeah, B, V, V, but what am I saying, V or B? Very hard to tell. That's why they're interchangeable phonetically, because they're phonetically identical in that sense. Then Kedar. So Kedar was his second one. We know about Kedar because it's mentioned in the Song of Solomon, where the bride describes herself as being dark, like the tents of Kedar. And when you read the context and you figure out, oh, she lives at a vineyard in the north of Israel. She's deeply suntanned, which the very refined ladies wouldn't be suntanned at all. What parasols were for. But she had to work with the vines, and so she was outdoors, so she was dark in that sense. Like the tents of Kedar. Tents of Kedar are usually made out of, and still to some degree are, in the 70s they were. Went to visit, when I was at the Dig in Jerusalem, my wife and I actually met there in 1973. The Big Dig was Ambassador College sent students in the summertime for 2 months to work on the archaeological excavations called the Temple Mount excavations, right in the center of Jerusalem, right in where David's palace would have been, and the next to where the temple had been. And so we were working there, and a friend of mine was an Englishman. He's one of those Englishmen that you understand why there was an empire. Brian could just walk into whatever room, and it didn't matter who it was. He understood them. Not necessarily understood what they said, but he just had this intuition as to what they needed. And so he would tell them, well, you need to do this and do that. Okay, and so they would do it. It's kind of like the British inherited their empire. They just walked in and said, okay, well, we're running this now. And so we want you to stop fighting with each other and start doing this and start doing that. And mostly people just did that. Well, he made a friend named Dawood. Dawood is the Arabic word for David. And Dawood was a Bedouin, a true Bedouin, which was one of the Arab, you know, the tribes of the Arabs. But the Bedouins in the 70s, they didn't know boundaries from anything. I mean, national boundaries. So he went to university in Saudi Arabia one season of the year, and then he would travel with his family. It meant his grandfather and his father and his many uncles and all their families. It was a, you know, pretty large clan. And they would just walk across the desert, and they would come to Jerusalem because the men all work in Jerusalem for a certain number of months every year. And so they had this place way out at the end of the city bus line. You got off the Arab bus line, and at that time they were pretty rickety old buses, but he got there. And they turned around right there and drove back to the city. There wasn't anything. There wasn't a signpost. There was just a fence. Five-wire, barbed-wire fence on that side of the road, and I think a dilapidated fence on that side. So that, well, maybe they're grazing grounds, but there was nobody. There were no buildings in sight. We got off. We climbed the fence. We started walking up the top of a hill that we were told to walk to the top of at a certain time. And as we're walking up, we see a head start coming up over the hill from the other way. It was Dawood. We met at the top. He welcomed us to his family's home. We walked over the ridge and looked down, and it's like stepping back centuries and centuries, millennia, the tents of Kedar. All the tents were dark brown with black stripes woven into them, and they were made out of goat's hair. And those were the homes of all of the all the families in the clan. And then they had a couple of white tents that were made out of linen or canvas. And one was the men's tent. That's where the men would come after work and they would drink tea and coffee and talk. And with grandfather sort of presiding, which is where we were escorted. And so we sat and visited with them and drank lots of tea and a little bit of bitter coffee. It wasn't roasted. And I don't know how they like that. I like coffee, but unroasted ground coffee is just got a whang to it. Someday I'm going to try it again because I'm sure there's got to be a way where it's good. Then we went to visit Dawood's uncle, his other uncle. He was five. Dawood was 21. It was his grandfather's fifth wife. So we went up to their tent, and she was honored that we would come to see her little boy. And she brought us a gift. The gift was round ball, white ball for each of us. We had no idea what they were. And Dawood did, but Brian and I didn't. We asked him, what are they? And so he went and asked her to verify. It was dried goat's milk. That when the goat dairy gives lots of milk at a certain time of the year, in the spring usually, then they end up with a big surplus. So instead of just pouring it out, because they really didn't sell it, and they couldn't consume it all, they would pour it out in pans and dry it. And then as it got nearly dry, they would scrape it out of the pan and pat it into a ball. And then the next day, they would make the ball larger until it's about the size of a tennis ball. And then those would sit in the sun and completely dehydrate, and they would sit them on a shelf and store them. So in the wintertime, when the goats didn't give as much milk, they just grabbed those off the shelf, put them in warm water, and rub them like you're rubbing your hands with soap until you constituted enough milk. And then you put it back on the shelf for the next time. So we were honored with that. But Dawood was the Bedouins, as I said, in those days, they didn't pay any attention to the Israeli border, the Arab borders. They moved from one nation to another nation like they owned the place. They don't think they get to do that anymore, not since 9/11. But Kedar is who Yair Dovidi thinks is the ancestor of some of the tribes, the American Indian tribes. Maybe not all, but some. And there's a distinct possibility. So what we find, I mean, where were we? We were Exodus, Genesis, and I got sidetracked. I apologize for the sidetracking. Tell you all those boring stories. Genealogy of, we got clear down to Kedar, Abdiel, Misham, Mishma, Duma, Masa, Hadar, Tima, Jetur, Nafish, and Kidma. These are all the sons of Ishmael, their names by their towns and their settlements, 12 princes according to their nations. And these were the years of Ishmael. And talks about that they dwelt from Havilah as far as Shur, which is east of Egypt as you go toward Assyria. So they stretched out from Egypt up toward Assyria in the northwestern section of Arabia and on up through the desert of what would be Iraq today toward Assyria, which would be up on the top of the Tigris River area. And that's where they dwelt at that time. They moved and migrated like everybody else did. The Kedarites are found migrating up into central Asia. Tajikistan has a very large Arab population. The Yingyang province of China does too, by the way, and they have a lot of unrest there because of that. So we know that the Arabs migrated during the time of Arab conquest in the 600s. And they would have put them up into Asia. Then comes along Genghis Khan, who conquers those peoples that are anywhere near China in the 1200s. And we have records of peoples that escaped from Genghis Khan by sailing away from the coast of China. And at that time, the Chinese fleet was quite significant and did apparently, according to historians of the North and South American Western coasts, that the Chinese did business with North and South America, or at least came to get things if they didn't do business with people who lived there. So his theory is that Kedar, an element of Kedar, not all of it, because the core of Kedar was still back in the northwest corner of Arabia, but a part of it had moved all the way up to Asia, taken in or being running, escaping from Genghis Khan's forces. They migrated across the ocean, whether by steps or by a full sailing ability. By the 1200s, that was not a problem. The Chinese had very advanced dhows, ships that could sail around the world. Bear in mind, circumnavigation of the earth was only prevented by the Roman Church because they said the earth is flat, and if you sail out there, you'll fall off. Well, that kept people back where they could control them, didn't it? The Europeans, anyway. Chinese weren't sort of under that, or those who were around there. So that's how he anticipates that the Kedarites came. The tents of Kedar are dark. And this is one of the markers that he uses. The Viking name for North America, one of the Viking names is Markland, meaning dark land. Talmudic tradition says the 10 tribes, now the Talmudic traditions are the rabbis, and so they would write histories, but their historical traditions were that the 10 tribes of Israel migrated to the clouds of darkness, the mountains of darkness. So the darkness is our key marker here. And that could be the Caucasus Mountains, because between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea, the bulk of the 10 tribes of Israel moved on into Europe by going up through the Dariel Pass, now also called the Scythian Pass or the Pass of Israel, over the Caspian, or the Caucasus Mountains, and then down and around the top end of the Black Sea and then spread out into Europe. Some came around across the Bosporus lower down, but most went through the Caucasus. They went into the mountains, the clouds and the darkness, because the clouds sit on top of the mountains. In principle, that could apply, is how Davidie argues it, that could apply to the Caucasus, to Scandinavia, because many of them ended up in Scandinavia, as well as the mountains of North America. So the whole land of North America could be called Kedar in that sense, dark. Now, in explaining that, let's just go to one of the passages he primarily uses, and you'll see it's in Isaiah 42. Isaiah 42. Now, to be fair, Mr. Davidie reckons from his research and the people that he studied histories that have been written about American Indians tribes, various tribes, since Dr. Ray wrote his work in the 60s. And what we find is some believe that he's right, that the Kedarites are parts or the ancestors of a few of the tribes, especially on the west coast. Not necessarily far inside America, but on the west coast of the Americas. So in chapter 42, you notice in verse 4, he will not fail nor be discouraged. This is the Messiah that's spoken of in the first verses. Till he has established justice in the earth, and the coastlands shall wait for his law. So now we're talking about the coastlands, distant lands from Israel. Thus says the God, the Eternal, who recreated the heavens and the earth and stretched them out and stretched forth the earth and that which comes from it, who gives breath to the people on it and spirit to those who walk on it. I, the Eternal, have called you in righteousness and will hold your hand. I will give you, or rather, I will keep you and will give you as a covenant to the people, a Brit Am. Covenant to or covenant of the people. A Brit Am is the Hebrew phrase that would be used there. As a light to the Gentiles, to open blind eyes and bring prisoners out from prison, and so on. That will be happening in the millennium. It has happened to a degree as a forerunner in our time. The descendants of the 10 tribes of Israel have produced that kind of knowledge of God and maintained it in the world. But it will certainly happen more so in the millennium. We come to verse 10 then. Sing to the Eternal, verse 10, a new song and his praise from the end of the earth. You who go down to the sea and all that is in it. So now we're talking about seafarers. You who go down to the sea. You coastlands and you inhabitants of them. Coastlands are inhabited by people who are seafarers. Or we're seafarers to get to the coast if they're different coastland, a distant one. Let the wilderness and its cities lift up their voice, the villages that Kedar inhabits, let the inhabitants of Selah or the rock sing. So the villages of Kedar, you go down to the sea. The rock here is, it can be a reference to Petra, which is near where the Kedarites in Arabia would have been. But we have Kedarites attached to those who are seafarers, or maybe they are seafarers themselves. And they are in distant lands. And the application here is that the tribes were seafaring. We know for certain Dan sailed, Asher sailed, Zebulun sailed. He would be a haven for ships. And then we find out that they all sailed eventually. A British being among the greatest, Ephraim. of the sailors, but the Manasseh, America, not being far behind. So Kedar here, he believes, is a reference to North America. And that Kedarites, some Kedarites are among the tribes, what we would call the indigenous peoples of America, which, you know, what do you mean by indigenous? Adam and Eve were indigenous. The rest of us are all migrants, you know, coming from one place and going to another. But whatever the case, they are the ancestors of some of the tribes. So we have the two possibilities, and I think good arguments in both cases. And you say, well, where's the truth? Well, probably both have truth as far as the origins of the tribes. Which tribes? It seems that those in the central and the eastern part of the United States would come through Javan, and some of the tribes on the west would not. Now, there's a lot more to the migrations of the Javan, of the Tiras people, the sons of Japheth, that we don't have time to cover today. In our final lecture on and Bible study on the, where the origins of the American Indians come from, we'll look at some of the movements and the cultures that were in America, because some of the tribes were actually Israelite. There's a strong, strong tradition that the Mandans, Mandan Indians of Montana and the Dakotas, who died in the early 1800s, they were attacked and destroyed ultimately, that they were in fact Celts. And there's a lot of reasons why that is, including one of the American painters, Gatland is his name, he would go and live with various Indian tribes and then paint them, paint their pictures. So we have a record of them from the 1830s and 20s. So we're going to talk about that. In the next one, we'll look at the other connections with Israel and where the migrations sort of all seem to blend together to give us the Native American Indians that we have in America today.